Andy Parks, live from the Washington Times.
Well, welcome back. It is 12:06 at 12:60 WRC. Andy Parks, live from the Washington Times. Happy Tuesday to you. And I know it's a very special day when I bring on Stephen Dynan, Washington Times political editor. I know he's full of excitement now because the budget, if I understand correctly, the president's budget arrived on Capitol Hill a little while ago. Is that right, Stephen?
Yeah, it was just released half an hour ago, so it's for all the folks up here who like that sort of thing, this is their Super Bowl.
All right, so I guess we have to pass it to find out what's in it. Oh, wait a minute, that was something else, wasn't it?
Yeah, no, this is you have to really, really, really care to want to know to find out what's in this. It's a really thick doc, actually it's several different volumes, and it's written in the worst of Washington speak, and it's really difficult to figure out what's in there. They do luckily release some handy tables. This one calls for, this is for fiscal year 2015. We're currently in, obviously, fiscal year 2014.
Right.
This would be for next year. It calls for spending a total of $3.9 trillion, and we would be taking in about $3.35 trillion in taxes, leaving us a deficit of about $560 billion. That would be the lowest in President Obama's tenure, by far the lowest in President Obama's tenure, way down from the 1.4, 1.5 trillion we had at some point. So there is some immediate good news, which is essentially the economy is doing well and the spending cuts of the past few years have actually brought us to this point. But the president basically halts progress at that level, and for the next 10 years, you would see deficits right around $500 billion every year. So he's basically saying, yeah, we're at about where I think is good enough. It's time to stop saving and start spending, and that's essentially what the budget does.
All right. Now, you and I spoke back, back around Christmas time, maybe before, about this budget and the fact that it would call for, if I recall correctly, what, $56 billion more in spending?
Yeah, somewhere on that order. It's between $50 and $60 billion.
All right. So what would that be? Education, infrastructure, research and development, all the stuff that we thought we already had paid for?
Yeah, and all the stuff that we do already pay for. You know, his argument is that we, thanks to sequesters, thanks to all the spending, it essentially boils down to this. He says, look, we've done a pretty good job of paring down the budget, but all of my priorities that I want, all day kindergarten for all students, preschool for all Americans, a climate change to begin dealing with adaptation for global warming, all these things that I want, I haven't been able to get done. It's time to stop cutting and time to start spending. And in order to spend, I know you guys, the president says, I know you guys are worried about the deficit, so I'll basically freeze the deficit at about $500 billion. But in order to be able to spend on what I want to spend on, I'm going to raise taxes. And so it's basically, he's giving Republicans maybe a quarter loaf and saying, okay, I understand you're concerned about deficits. I won't make the deficits any worse, but I'm not going to make them any better. And I'm going to spend more and raise taxes to do it.
All right. So what does John Boehner do with this? Do we know?
Those people who actually still do get the budget in paper copy, most of them, most Republicans will probably just ship it straight from their door to the trash can. It is almost irrelevant as a document. It certainly in the broad scope of things, it's irrelevant as a document. There may be small individual changes to line items that he's proposing that will get some attention from the appropriations committees that actually do the dollar by dollar spending. But by and large, as an overall outline, it's not going to really change the debate up here on Capitol Hill. And House Republicans are going to try and pass a budget this year. Senate Democrats have already said they're not going to try and pass a budget this year, which means that we will go for the fifth straight year, I believe, without Congress having passed a unified overall budget. And it will be except for last year, the Senate hasn't passed a budget since 2009. So we're completely budgetarily broken. These documents mean less and less each year.
I think a lot of people had held out hope that Paul Ryan and Patty Murray would get together on something and maybe there would be, a final product.
Sure, yeah, and last year's deal in December suggested that was possible. Now, the difference here, the problem is that while Paul Ryan is going to go ahead and write, so the deal that came through in December set overall overall discretionary spending levels for 2014, which were the bills that we just went ahead and passed in January, I guess, and it already set an overall discretionary spending level for 2015. So Senate Democrats say, we've already done the most important thing that a budget does. We've agreed on a top-line amount of money that Congress can dole out, and the discretionary budget, of course, is what Congress doles out each year. The mandatory side of spending is what's already fixed in law, and all the entitlements, Social Security, Medicare, that sort of thing. Congress doesn't really touch those every year, but they do touch the discretionary spending every year. We already have an overall number for that, so now it's just a matter of going ahead and dividing that that amount up into the different bills. Given that we have this overall budget number, Senate Democrats say, but anything we would do there would sort of mess around with that. We have an agreement. We're not going to go in and try and undo it. It was so difficult already getting that first agreement that let's just keep it there. Republicans are going to try and mess around with that number, but of course, given that the Senate's not going to, the Republican document will be a dead document from the moment they pass it as well. So, we're basically in a holding pattern on all of this, as we have been for much of the last few years. We lurch on into crises, we get a deal done in those crises, and then we sit around and wait for the next election to try and solve things, and so far that hasn't happened.
Yeah. All right, I want to move to something else. Supreme Court refuses to rule on city's illegal immigration law. This is something that I actually talked to Congressman Lou Barletta about, I want to say last May at an event he and I both attended, and this is about Hazleton, Pennsylvania, and it was regarding a crackdown on illegal immigrants, right?
That's right. It was a local ordinance that would, actually a set of ordinances, that would have made it, it would have required people who are renting to check the legal status of those they are renting to. And so it's a way of basically trying to push illegal immigrants out of the town. And, of course, this is, the question is whether a town can actually enact an ordinance that appears to deal with immigration. And the Supreme Court refused to hear the case, which means that the lower appeals court's ruling, which overturned that ordinance, still stands. So basically, Hazleton got shut down by an appeals court, and by the Supreme Court not taking the case, that appeals court ruling stands.
Okay. All right. And then finally today, national park shutdown cost local economies $400 million. Wow. You mean the shutdown that probably didn't have to be as severe as it turned out to be?
Yeah, the one where we barricaded the parking lots along the GW Parkway, but left the GW Parkway and the bike trail next to it open. Yeah. The one where we barricaded the open air memorials on the mall because the Park Service didn't think they could pick up the trash there, and so ended up spending more money, according to at least Republicans, ended up spending more money to staff the barricades with manpower to keep people out than they would have to staff it for normal use. So, you know, it's, yes, this is one of those things where this was essentially the Park Service saying, look, we told you all it was bad to shut us down, and here's the proof that it was bad to shut us down. Of course, opponents look at it and say, well, this is why you didn't have to make it as bad as you did. You intentionally made it worse than it should have been, and we don't really solve that. You know, the two sides sit there and stare at each other and complain.
All right, now, some of these parks generate big cash on their own, actually make a profit. And weren't some of those, I'm trying to think, some of them were reopened by the individual states, right?
That's right. So, for example, Arizona paid to reopen the Grand Canyon 5 days before the shutdown ended for everybody else. Utah actually has 5 different national parks in the southern part and a couple of other national monuments and national historic areas. They paid to reopen those 6 or 7 days early because they're so important to the local economies out there. And that is, you know, that's what the Park Service report says, is yes, these parks do end up producing, they bring people who pay for gas, who pay for rooms, who pay for food, who pay for, you know, around the Grand Canyon, they end up paying for helicopter rides around the Grand Canyon, all sorts of different concessions and stuff that go on around these parks. The parks really are, they're wonderful things that do draw a lot of people, and those people do spend money. The question is, you know, how far did the Park Service have to go in shutting things down, and how much of this economic activity could have kept going even in the middle of a shutdown? It's also interesting, it's tough to figure out exactly what to do with this report, because the Park Service also showed there were some parks that actually seemed to see better visitation in during the shutdown than they did in the previous few years, including the CNO Canal, which is a National Historic Site here in Washington. It runs all the way the length of the CNO Canal. But that actually saw an uptick in visitors and an uptick in spending around it. So, you know, go figure exactly what conclusions you want to draw from that.
Yep. All right. They got about 30 seconds left. Anything big happening the rest of the week?
Well, we were going to have sort of a weird fight over flood insurance in the House. We have Lois Lerner scheduled to testify in the House also, and then the Senate's going to have just a couple of wonderful big blow-up fights on nominations. So a lot of standard sort of stuff that could produce some political heat. Nothing that's going to really change Washington upside down.
All right, very good, Stephen. Thanks for your help. Appreciate it.
My pleasure, Andy.
Stephen Dinan, Washington Times political editor. It's 1216 at 1260 WRC. Stay tuned. Clifford May, president of the Foundation for Defense of Democracies, will join me in just a couple of minutes, and we'll talk about the latest coming out of Ukraine.